So it's such a gift to have three generations of Bach leading us in music, and Paul, you too. Thank you for that music this morning. At our last church workday, Jared, with his big heart, got up on this big roof and was cleaning out the gutters. And the rest of us were working at other places, and we finished up our jobs. It was kind of a rainy day, and we maybe quit a few minutes early, packed up and went home, forgetting that Jared was still up here on the roof and that the ladder that was taking him back down was also one of the things we packed up. It's really a sad story. So Jared, I don't know why every time I think about it, I want to chuckle, but I have that impulse. But I could imagine, in my better moments of empathy, I could imagine Jared coming to the edge of the roof, balancing, looking down where the ladder was supposed to be and saying, "What have I gotten myself into, and what do I do now?" I've had a few of those moments the last couple of weeks as I agreed to take on the topic of Jesus as prophet, of sort of peering over the edge and saying, "What have I gotten myself into, and what do I do now?" This is complicated. A prophet is one who speaks for God, so clearly, Jesus was a prophet. Jesus, our present teacher, is prophetic. But what does that mean for those of us who strive to walk, as we sung this morning, in the Jesus way? Does that mean that we speak for God also? Well, yes, I think so. Probably. Sometimes. It's complicated. So, today, we're going to venture into a sort of complicated part of our faith, and I'm going to use the words goat and asterisk to guide us into these murky places. Now, you're probably assuming, because the word goat is one of those two, and I'm a McMinn, that I'm about to talk about those cute Nigerian dwarf goats that Lisa tends on our farm. And I will leave that to Lisa. If you hang around her for much time at all, you'll likely hear about these fun little creatures. But my reference is to all caps, goat, as in greatest of all time. Jesus was the greatest prophet of all time. There are many prophets in Scripture: Abraham, Moses, Deborah, Anna, Elijah, just to name a few. There's many more. Plus, there's people who have spoken for God since the Bible, including friends in our own tradition. But there's only one goat. As Christians, we take Jesus to be the perfect representation of God's image. The gospel writer John describes Jesus as the Word, the eternal Word that became flesh and dwelt among us. When Jesus speaks, Jesus is speaking for God, with God, of God. And what I'd like to say here is that whenever Jesus spoke, he offered words of comfort and love and compassion and kindness. And there were so many of those times. He healed the sick, he fed the hungry, he gave sight to the blind, he welcomed the children, he showed mercy to the social outcasts. When a woman was about to be stoned, he saved her life with these words of kindness. He said, "Let him who is without sin cast the first stone." When he was in agony, dying on the cross, he looked out and saw his mother and felt compassion for her and asked John to care for her. Jesus wept anguished tears at the suffering of the world when his friend Lazarus had died. Jesus was so kind, and he was being prophetic in his kindness. He was speaking for God, showing this compassion. Several years ago, amidst a particularly painful season of life, I found this book to be so meaningful. Gentle and Lowly, The Heart of Christ for Sinners and Sufferers. And in the first chapter, we read the same words that Paul called us to worship with this morning. The author writes this: "In only one place, perhaps the most wonderful words ever uttered by human lips, do we hear Jesus himself open up to us his very heart. Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. And can we just stop here? Can we just move into open worship with our hearts tuned to the kindness of Jesus? His kindness was stunning, and it was prophetic. Jesus was always speaking for God, who had a heart of compassion. But no, we can't just stop here. Because sometimes the voice of God turns things upside down, like the money changers' tables in the temple and entire religious systems that got turned upside down. David Brooks is a columnist for the New York Times and one who's been open about his conversion to Christianity over the past decade. A month ago, he wrote this in the Times. "These days I go to church more than synagogue, but I've learned you can't take the Jew out of the boy. I'm attracted to Jesus the Jew, not the wispy, ethereal, gentle face guy with his two fingers in the air whom Christians have invented and put into centuries of European paintings. The Jewish Jesus emerged amid revolution, violence, and strife. He walked into the center of all the clashing authority structures, and he overturned them, excuse me, he overturned them all. The Jewish, The Jewish Jesus was a total badass. And I'm not sure I can say badass in church, but I'm pretty sure Jesus would have. He stirred things up. He healed on the Sabbath, which was scandalous to the religious leaders of his day. He hung out with disreputable people. He killed a fig tree because the tree wasn't bearing fruit. And as Colin reminded us last week, he sent a herd of pigs into the water where they drowned, which is not a good day for the pigs or for their owners. Jesus was provocative. Sometimes he was a troublemaker. In John 2, Jesus shows up in the temple right before the Jewish Passover and famously does this. In the temple area, he saw merchants selling cattle, sheep, and doves for sacrifices. He also saw dealers at tables exchanging foreign money. Jesus made a whip from some ropes and chased them all out of the temple. He drove out the sheep and the cattle, scattered the money changers' coins over the floors, and turned over their tables. Then going to the people who sold doves, he told them, "Get these things out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a marketplace." Somehow I've always wanted to think that Jesus found a whip lying on the ground. But no, John says he made a whip. He knew what he was doing. This is Jesus, the greatest prophet of all time, the one who speaks for God. In Luke 4, which is our passage, our scripture passage for today, I'm not going to read it, but I wonder if we can kind of imagine it. To imagine it, let's imagine ourselves to be gathered on a Sabbath day in Nazareth in the synagogue. And for just a moment, let's imagine that I'm standing before you as Jesus. I realize I'm twice his age, I'm the wrong ethnicity, and there's a whole other host of reasons why I'm not like Jesus. But let's imagine it for just a moment. And I stand in the synagogue, and I ask the attendant to give me the scroll of Isaiah. And I open up the scroll, and I find the place that we now call Isaiah 61. And Jesus reads this with authority. "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, for he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim that the captives will be released, that the blind will see, that the oppressed will be set free, and that the time of the Lord's favor has come." And then Jesus rolls up the scroll, he hands it to the attendant, and then he goes and he sits down. And then he says one more thing. He says, "Today, this scripture has come true in front of your very eyes." And there's a gasp. People turn to one another and they say, "Isn't this Jesus, the son of Joseph and Mary?" There's a sense of amazement. But then the gravity of those words starts to settle in.
The audacity of Jesus would last me.
Before we know it, this amazed crowd, Jesus says a few more words about prophets not being welcome in their hometown. And before we know it, this amazed crowd is an enraged crowd. This is what happens next. When they heard this, the people in the synagogue were furious. Jumping up, they mobbed him and forced him to the edge of the hill on which the town was built. They intended to push him over the cliff, but he passed right through the crowd and went on his way. This is Jesus, who is audacious and unpredictable. He stirred things up. Notice, too, the words later in his ministry that he had for religious leaders. Here's some of the words. I thought these little three-dot things, I didn't know there was a word for them. I mean, who knew? But you all probably did. But it's called an ellipse. I always just called it dot, dot, dot. I'm going to read, but those little dot, 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 there's a lot of real estate in between there. There's just 30 verses of Jesus saying some pretty harsh, pointed things to religious leaders. Everything they do is for show. They love to receive respectful greetings as they walk in the marketplaces and to be called rabbi. Don't let anyone call you rabbi, for you have only one teacher, and all of you are equal as brothers and sisters. But those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. What sorrow awaits you teachers of religious law and you Pharisees, hypocrites, snakes, sons of vipers. Jesus, speaking for God, critiqued and undermined the religious leaders so powerfully that they killed him. Can you imagine making the Ministerial Association of Newburgh or Portland, Oregon, so angry with you that they wanted to execute you? This is the murky, complicated part of talking about Jesus as a prophet. On one hand, the compassion of Jesus reveals the loving heart of God. But on the other hand, speaking for God sometimes meant getting upset and overturning things. The same Jesus who said, "Come to me, all you who are weary," also called people out, sometimes with very strong words. And remember where we started, on the edge of the roof, peering over, trying to find balance. What do we do with this? My hunch is that most of us are inclined toward the compassionate Jesus more than the bold, confrontational Jesus. So what do we do with that part of Jesus that turns things upside down? In our tradition, we have a history of friends speaking out boldly for social reform. Quakers have been centrally involved in the abolition of slavery and women's rights to vote, women's rights to education, prison reform, humane treatment for those with serious mental illness, protection of Native people, of peacemaking. Ours is a tradition of speaking out, and we sit here today emboldened and blessed by friends who have gone before us. They've turned some things upside down. And what do we do with this? Well, the obvious answer is we prepare ourselves. Sometimes we may be called to speak out, to get out of our comfort zone, to speak loudly for God, as Jesus did, and as many in our friends' tradition have done. But still, it's complicated. And that's why we need an asterisk. The thing is, I'm fully human, as Jesus was, but I'm not fully divine. God knows, and so does everyone else who knows me well, I am far from the goat when it comes to speaking for God. I sometimes think it's amusing how much we care about identifying the greatest of all time in our various fields. I mean, was it Mozart or Beethoven? Marta or Mia Hamm? Jordan or James? Serena Williams or Billie Jean King? People pay big money to create polls about this stuff, and I suppose it's what we do. We clamor to figure out who's the best. But when it comes to being prophetic, when it comes to speaking for God, there's only one goat, and there's not even a second. There's not a close second to be found. So that's the asterisk. We won't speak for God as well as Jesus did, which calls for a whole lot of humility and community. Lee Ross was a professor at Stanford in 1977 when he discovered the fundamental attribution error. It goes like this. If I have a problem, I'll explain it according to some situation I'm facing. If you have a problem, I'll explain it according to a character flaw. So for example, if I get a ticket for running a red light, it's because the sun was in my eyes. If you get a ticket for running a red light, it's because you're a bad driver. And so that's the fundamental attribution error. You've probably heard of it. It's 50 years ago, since 1977, it's been on the internet a lot. People hear about the fundamental attribution error. What's less known is that Dr. Ross then stayed at Stanford for his whole career. He continued to do laboratory studies and worked on conflict resolution in the Middle East. And shortly before his death in 2021, he wrote an article not quite renouncing the fundamental attribution error, but suggesting a better way to think about this. It's what he's calling here the truly fundamental attribution error, which he also calls naive realism. And this occurs in three steps. The first step is I believe myself to know the truth. The second is I assume that if you know what I know, you're certain to agree with me. And then the third step is if you still don't agree with me, then you're a fool or whatever else you might choose to fill in that blank with. Now I have the perfect illustration of this, but I don't want to tell you because it's so deeply embarrassing. But I still am going to. Lisa and I often will hike at the Trappist Abbey on summer Sunday evenings. And so one time last summer, and it's usually very lovely, but one time last summer we were making it less than lovely by having a little dispute about something so minor. We were trying to figure out if we were on the same path as we went the week before. I said yes, Lisa said no. Looking back, it's all quite silly. If you're going to have a dispute, shouldn't it be at least about something important? But here we were, hiking and disagreeing and feeling annoyed with one another. Now, clearly, I was right. We were on the same path. I knew the truth. I mean, the contour of the land, the way the path, the canopy of the trees, it's all very clear. And she just wasn't convinced, which made me really annoyed. Then I said something so stupid, something after 45 years of marriage, one would assume you know not to say this. I said to Lisa, I said, you have such a hard time admitting when you're wrong. I know, you know, terrible thing to say. Don't try this at home. And yes, I'm a psychologist, which makes it even worse, right? But it still got worse because around the next bend, I started looking a little differently at the topography and the path and the canopy of the trees. And I suddenly had this growing awareness, oh my, it's me. I'm the one who's wrong. I'm the one that has such a hard time admitting it when I'm wrong. And I would never, ever tell you that story if it weren't such a perfect illustration of naive realism. I know the truth. If you know what I know, you'll agree with me. And if you don't, then I deserve to call you some bad name. Sorry. But Leslie reminded us a couple weeks ago that we sometimes make God in our own image, which is naive realism. Lee Ross and his colleagues studied this too. They asked liberal and conservative Christians to give their opinions on certain social issues. And they also asked them what Jesus would have to say about the same issues. So the light bars on this graph are what individuals believed in the study, and the dark bars are what they perceived Jesus would say. Now, this particular question was about taxing the wealthy. Liberal Christians say Jesus would agree with them, and conservative Christians say Jesus would agree with them. They found the same results on all kinds of issues, undocumented immigrants, access to abortion, and more. Now, I want to be careful. I want to clarify something here. This doesn't mean we're wrong in our beliefs. You and I have convictions on certain issues. And some of those bring us together as a community. I don't assume we're wrong in our values. In fact, I think we're right. But let's remember that there are faith communities meeting right here in Newburgh, sitting on their chairs and their pews, and they're just as convinced as we are that Jesus sees it as they do. And that's what makes genuine conversation so difficult and yet so very important. Here's another reason for the asterisk. It's so easy in our social media culture to pronounce what we believe to be true. Maybe it's too easy. I'm kind of an Excel geek, so I did this thing. There are 88 prophets that are mentioned or featured in the Bible, which spans over about 4,000 years. So I made this Excel sheet. I Googled the world population and the average lifespan, and I came up with this number. The percentage of people that were prophets in that time was 0.0000004%. Now, my math's a little off because there probably were prophets that weren't mentioned in the Bible. But still, it was a very low number of people. I wonder today what percentage of Christians perceive themselves to speak for God. We all have a platform, and most of us have plenty of hubris, so we need the asterisk. The third reason for the asterisk is to remember the balance that Jesus showed. Yes, he spoke assertively. He turned things upside down. He confronted people directly. But it's so easy to get this out of balance. Jesus was also profoundly gentle and humble. He was kind beyond measure. What if we forget kindness, as I did on that hike, and then turn out to be wrong, or even just partly? This can cause harm. Maybe the person we're with in this moment needs compassion more than confrontation. David French is another columnist for the New York Times. He wrote this post just 3 days after David Brooks wrote the one I showed earlier. Most of us have sound enough moral instincts to reject the notion that might makes right. Power alone is not a sufficient marker of righteousness. The idea that right deserves might is different and may even be more destructive. It appeals to our ambition, to our virtue, which is what makes it especially treacherous. It masks its darkness. It's remarkable how often ambition becomes cruelty. In our self-delusion, we persuade ourselves that we're not just right, but that we're so clearly right that opposition has to be rooted in arrogance and evil. We lash out. We seek to silence and destroy our enemies. But it's all for the public good, so we sleep well at night. We become one of the most dangerous kinds of people, a cruel person with a clear conscience. We live in a time where it is so easy to pronounce our views loudly. But what if we're wrong? What if we're cruel? What if we're both wrong and cruel? Yes, Quakers have a history of speaking out for social reform. But we also have a history of quiet, learning to sit still in the silence, to discern, to wait for God. We desperately need the disciplines of quiet to prepare ourselves for the times when we may need to speak out. Friends, we have a tightrope to walk here. If we lean too far to one side, we fail to speak the truth to a world prone to abuse power. And if we lean too far the other way, if we speak impulsively without wise discernment, we fail to show the kindness and humility of Jesus. And sometimes we may even become the ones abusing our power. Jesus, the mighty prophet, is also Jesus, the self-emptying servant. He walked that tightrope perfectly. But we're not as good as Jesus. We're going to be tipsy. We're going to stumble. We're going to fall off sometimes. And it speaks to how much we need one another to help us find balance. And we need quiet. Teach us, Jesus, to stop and listen. Teach us to center down. Teach us the use of silence. Teach us where peace is found.